Let us start a second part of this morning session. We are still in science and the governance of international commons. And in this second part, we have like to have a panel discussion with audience from you. And at this part, I would like to discuss about relation of the Antarctic Treaty and other international institutions. In the morning, in the first part, we have learned about several different international treaty convention and so on, about law of the seas and related civil conventions, or international convention for the regulation of whaling, or Montreal Protocol related to convention of Wien Convention of Ozone Protection. And now we would like to know about the relation of Antarctic Treaty and those each institution, or learn the similarity or difference between each treaty convention and relation, what is the relation to Antarctic Treaty, or so on. And finally, I would like to recognize the importance of science for these treaty or convention and international institutions, and so how to manage our futures using these institutions. So for the panelists, we have five panelists now. Three are from morning talk, and two another panelists we have here. One is Ambassador Berguno, who is already introduced several times, but he works for several decades for the Antarctic Treaty as a Chilean delegate and head of delegates, so on. And finally, we have another panelist, Professor Hanli Wang. He is a professor of international law and marine affairs, director of research base for ocean affairs and the law of the sea, the Institute for International Laws, Chinese Academy of Social Science, China. And he was expert nominated by China under Annex 8 of Special Arbitration of the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, and also consultant to the Division for Ocean Affairs and the Law of the Sea of the Office of Legal Affairs of the United Nations. And so first, shall we have some speech from another additional panelist. So shall we have first from Professor Hanli Wang?
Thank you.
So please.
And good morning, everyone. The theme of this panel is the interaction between Antarctic Treaty System and other international regime. And just now, the three speakers have discussed about ocean dumping, whaling, and ozone layer, which are three important aspects of protection of Antarctic environment and resources. However, the Antarctica faces many other issues and problems, mainly resulting from the following. First, environmental pollution, degradation of marine resources, as well as climate change. And second, although the exploitation of mineral resources are banned by the Antarctic Treaty System, new resources, including marine living and mineral resources, have also create new legal issues. For example, the genetic resources have always been a major concern. Some legal issues have been raised. For example, the distinction between exploration and survey for scientific purpose and commercial purpose, and distinction between the use of military personnel or equipment for scientific research or for peaceful purposes and military purposes and non-peaceful purposes. As we all know, misuse of military marine scientific research and surveys have caused international conflicts. Another aspect of new resources also have caused problems now and in the future, maybe. For example, bioprospecting will also raise new legal issues, including the intellectual property rights issues. And third, the new uses and developments of Antarctic resources, for example, the development of tourism in the Arctic, which have caused environmental problems and safety concerns of marine shipping in the Antarctic region. And fourthly, transboundary issues also cause great concern in the Antarctic. The application scope of Antarctic treaties are limited to the Antarctica, although CAMLA provides that the resources within and outside the Antarctic conversion has to be taken into consideration as a whole, as the for the purpose of the ecosystem integrity. However, the transboundary issues of the Antarctic region are also a great concern. And last, I would like to mention that the recent submissions of the outer limit of the continental shelf by some countries, which involve parts of the seabed of the Antarctica, also challenge the foundation of the Antarctic Treaty. All these issues and problems involve many existing international conventions and agreements, including the Convention on the Law of the Sea, Convention on Biodiversity, and many other IMO conventions on safety of marine shipping and prevention of pollution from shipping. Regarding UNCLOS, some of its provisions might be inconsistent or even conflict with the relevant provisions of the Antarctic treaties. For example, UNCLOS provides that coastal states have rights to claim 200 nautical miles of EEZ and 200 to 350 nautical miles of continental shelf, while the Antarctic Treaty frees all the territorial claims of any state. So there is a conflict or inconsistency between the UNCLOS and the Antarctic Treaty. Regarding the Convention on Biodiversity, how to regulate and preserve biodiversity in those areas beyond national jurisdiction is under discussion. This includes the polar region. And as to the IMO conventions and their guidelines and standards might not be applicable to the polar region because of the different conditions in the polar region and other sea areas. That is to say, the polar shipping requires higher or stricter standards than the existing ones. The last issue I want to mention is national legislation on the Antarctic. The protection of the Antarctic ecosystem requires not only Antarctic Treaty System and other international conventions and agreements, but also national legislation, especially for those countries which conduct fishing, scientific exploration and research, and tourism, as well as other activities in the Antarctica. So this is an important aspect that this conference has not touched upon so far. Thank you for your attention.
Okay, thank you very much, Professor Wang. And shall we have some message from
Mr. Chairman? I would like first to congratulate all the participants that have made the presentations this morning, because we have more food for thought from their participation than just before it took place. I thought that the presentation by Professor van der Zoog of the world that comes out of the London Convention and its protocol, and the way he sorted the incompatibilities and the harmonizations with other bodies was an element that we have to necessarily consider when we confront not just those elements but that came in his presentation, but all the others that are included in the issues of whaling and in the issues regarding the Montreal Protocol. So my approach would be that we require to face all these challenges that you have put forth. We require an integrative approach, an approach where we must look and see what the actual practice has been. When Susan Solomon made her presentation, she recalled that the Antarctic stations were already witnessing and participating in the work to have a higher and stronger vigilance of the ozone hole development. So the complementarity of the treaty with these bodies is essential to understand. When it comes to the Biodiversity Convention, well, the Biodiversity Convention defines its scope in its Article 22, and one can see that the Biodiversity Convention must and has accepted the protocol and the environmental system of the treaty. However, I mean, it has a reservation that, of course, if the Antarctic proceeds to destroy its own environment, the CBD may be operational as a last resort. I was a bit surprised when Professor van der Zoog said that the prohibition under the Basel Convention of dumping would be operative, because technically transportation under the Basel Convention needs both, let's say, a center and an importer, and technically you cannot foresee that importer, since, of course, the protocol's assumption is that you will not import any alien element. However, the fact is, I would say, that these challenges, which have been put forth very well by you, Professor Wang, are by necessity to be faced with new developments, with a closer work, let's say, between CAMELAR and the Whaling Commission. It is not really appropriate that the Antarctic system is entirely out of an Antarctic sanctuary and has not a say on that. So there is work there. I do not share, however, Professor Wang's opinion on the issue of the continental shelf. I think that when we negotiated the Minerals Convention, we defined the continental shelf by Article 76. And by doing that, we defined a way to make compatible the law of the sea with the Antarctic Treaty and the Antarctic Treaty System. And the exercise by claimant countries making claims to a continental shelf, which is the natural prolongation of their territory, cannot be construed as developing a new claim. Of course, they are making presentations, but they should, and they must, and they should make those presentations with the provision that the Commission should take no action on those presentations, which is a way to preserve this balance, because I don't think that they are contradictions. I think they are gaps, and these gaps are filled in international law if you have the political will to do it and you have the creative power to make this integration of bodies which necessarily proliferate and necessarily constitute today a very complex legal and political mass, but the Antarctic Treaty has to address those, and the problem of which, what is the boundary of the Antarctic Treaty System, I think is now so much on the spot that we had at the last consultative meeting some problem in approving a resolution which called to protect the whole Antarctic environment. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ambassador. So shall we just discuss this point first? How about Professor Fontan?
On the Basel Convention, you're quite right. I mean, it was set up mainly to deal with the prior informed consent of importing states from hazardous waste from exporting states. But when they got into the Antarctic, they obviously, you know, got rid of that transboundary requirement. So they actually made it very much, you know, just don't export it down there. So it is a kind of a unique way they dealt with it. And it is kind of exceptional for what the convention is overall set up to do. But it's a major, I think, advancement, because that really is probably the most kind of waste would go down to the Antarctic, right? Because you're not going to be able to get rid of your hazardous waste in most countries. Yes. And so that's, I think, was a very creative way they dealt with it under Basel.
Okay. How about you? flat rooms. So from now, oh.
Thank you very much. I would like to follow up what Ambassador Jorge Burgundio just said. We have a proliferation of international agreements, and it's very often very complicated to coordinate them. He mentioned the relationship between the Antarctic Treaty legal system on the one side, the law of the sea, and other international agreements, Basel, etc. But we have also such a proliferation, law of the sea on one side, and biodiversity convention. I'm glad Ambassador Burgundio already mentioned Article 22 of the Biodiversity Convention, which indicates that the Biodiversity Convention does not apply or does not encroach upon the rights and obligations under the law of the sea system. And this brings me to the project of fertilization, the LoHaFlex project, which was a bit debated. Actually, the criticism came from Canada. Now I know where it came from. For it was a small, in Germany, totally unknown NGO who brought it up. Okay, you are quite powerful, I see. You created a cabinet crisis in Germany. But that's not my point. My point is the following. First of all, let us try to be faithful to the London Dumping Convention. The dumping is defined in the convention, and in that respect, you better correct your PowerPoint. It has two elements. First, the disposal of waste, that's the objective part, and then the subjective part, you must dispose with the intent to dispose. This is written into the convention, that's nothing new. And this fertilization was certainly not a disposal for the disposal, but for something else. Therefore, this fertilization project does not fall under the London Dumping Convention. You didn't mention that the Biodiversity Convention, that's the other aspect, does not cover that area at all. The scope of the Biodiversity Convention is limited, namely, as I indicated, not to encroach upon rights and obligations of states' parties, of the law of the sea. And freedom of scientific research is one of the freedoms guaranteed in the law of the sea convention. We should stick to that. And therefore, I would warn to isolate one convention. They have to be seen in context and as a whole, and therefore the LoHaFlex experiment, it may have been scientifically unsuccessful, which I don't know. I'm only a lawyer. I can't judge upon that. But legally, it was a very safe experiment. And whatever has been said in the future on that, we'll see. Thank you.
Okay, so.
Could I say something? I am very interested by what Professor Waltram has said, but I think that we have the challenge not just of sea fertilization, but many other uses of the ocean, many new uses. And in your intervention, Professor, you mentioned several of those. One question that I would like to put to not just our panel here, but to the audience as a whole, is the suggestion which has been made in workshops convoked to examine the situation of the law of the sea, of following the path of the agreements for application. We have an agreement for application of Part 11. We have an agreement for application of the law of the sea to Stradling and highly migratory stocks. So the notion of an agreement for the application of the law of the sea to the marine environment is an approach that has been devised. It's a bold one, but it's precisely triggered to see to what extent what is conceived as marine research, and the marine research has, as you say, rightly to be preserved, how it should not go beyond those mounds and become, as Professor Wang has supposedly said, I hope I am not misinterpreting him, that some of that research may have a non-peaceful effect and therefore could be in contradiction with the treaty.
So please.
Second question.
Yes, I'd like to follow up really on what's been said already and push it in maybe a slightly different direction. When we talk about these questions of interplay, institutional interplay, there's a tendency, a natural tendency, I think, to raise questions about possible interference or conflict or issues that need to be reconciled. But there's also the possibility of synergy, a kind of positive interaction where the sum may be, the whole may be greater than the sum of the parts. A spectacular example, of course, is raised by Steve Anderson and his presentation of the interaction between Montreal and Kyoto with respect to climate. But bringing it to the Antarctic case, I wonder if members of the panel might talk a little bit about either actual or potential opportunities for synergy between the regimes that you all were talking about in the Antarctic case. I think there may have been a little bit of that in Nicola's presentation with whaling and Camelot. I mean, can we see more opportunities for positive interaction, sort of reinforcing interaction between activities under whaling and activities under Camelot, and even ocean fertilization? I mean, are there opportunities between dumping and Camelot, for example, to move us toward our kind of collective community goals of good governance and dealing with the environment? On the question of ozone, has the Antarctic done its job by, as Steve pointed out, highlighting the issue in the early stages, or are there still synergies to be had from this point onwards? So I'd like to kind of push us a little bit in the direction of seeing if the panel might talk a bit about synergy or positive interactions, as well as some of the kind of rough edges that have to be worked out, which, of course, are very important as well.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much. We have good proposals. So shall we have any response
from from my perspective, what I was trying to convey, at least in part of my talk, was the need that you can't look at whales in isolation of anything else in the marine environment. So it is very important that we cooperate with others, and there's a whole raft of things that we need to cooperate with on and do, I think. I don't think we don't necessarily have we haven't been focusing on problems between treaties, but the problem is, like I was also trying to say, is how you actually have effective cooperation, because, you know, now we've recently there's an emerging issues, you know, like I talked about noise. That's an issue where, you know, we can't work on our own. Climate change, we can't work on our own. And so we are looking for cooperation. But again, it's really difficult to do it effectively. There's so many issues going on, and actually relatively few people working on in some respects, quite a small pool of talent to work with. And just actually doing it is effectively is really quite difficult, and I think it is a major change. And you can pay lip service a lot of the time to cooperation, because you can say, well, we cooperate because we go to each other's meetings, and that's not real true cooperation. You may understand a bit about what's going on, and you meet people, which is probably a very valuable thing to do. But meaningful cooperation is difficult. I think particularly now with all of the different issues that we're faced with.
Yeah, just on the synergies. I mean, I certainly in ocean dumping, I think it's a great synergy because you have basically the international regime dealing with the waste from without coming in. And then, of course, the Antarctic Treaty really dealing with the waste generated within. So you have this kind of blend, which is interesting. I think the ocean fertilization is more difficult because there you have, obviously, ocean fertilization that's going to take and has taken place outside the Antarctic Southern Ocean area. So it is more of a kind of global, although it's not going to be all over the world. And, of course, even the Antarctic regime actually would apply, assuming with the environmental impact assessment for ocean fertilizations that would trigger the EIA requirements under Annex 1. So, I mean, there is a synergy there already. But essentially, you're into some kind of global addressing of the two under the London Convention Protocol, which is occurring.
I think that there are three areas that need attention. First of all, I think there's tremendous legal talent in many of these multilateral agreements, and that it would be useful to have attorneys cross-advise each other on the structure of the treaties and the protocols and the enforcement mechanisms and the like, and I think there's a lot can be learned there. Operationally, Nicola mentioned that they had brought in experts to help with diplomacy and negotiations, and I think that's another area that you could get tremendous synergy to find successful negotiations from one treaty that would bring those tools over and the techniques and the strategies that were used in order to reach these consensus. And then finally, I think everyone in all the treaties struggles with the problem of communicating the problem to the public. And when I think about Antarctica, my list of sort of the takeaway messages and the signature images of Antarctica are the ozone hole, the heroic exploration of the Antarctic, and the imagination that that brings to readers. The slaughter of whales is very vivid, and there's a lot of materials for that. The acid ocean is becoming a big issue, and I think people could translate that from Antarctic to other places because some of the most fragile areas will be there. But what I'm suggesting is that each of the treaties struggles with communicating to policymakers and the public the tremendous challenge and the risk of damaging these resources permanently. And if you had cross-fertilization and synergy, you might find an expert from one treaty that's been brilliant at science communication and imagery and have them take that to another treaty and create a communication experiment that might bring the treaties closer together, but also might just be a handoff of some really good advice and talent.
Yeah, thank you, Rose. So, yeah.
Thank you. I don't know whether this is a question or a comment, but I think it follows from the last two particularly well. The question of synergy and the question of communication. And the communication is actually on the basis of you can't communicate something unless you are actually participating in what's going on. And I think Nikki made the point, and I think it's a very common problem being faced in a lot of international organizations and regional fisheries bodies in particular, is the whole issue of capacity. Antarctica is a global commons. We live in a world of globalization, and we're living of a world of global change. And the involvement in terms of understanding from the science, but I think it's probably as much a shortfalling in policy as well, is how do the people who wish to be engaged, or even the states in the case of one looks at something like the Fish Stocks Agreement, where there's actually specific linkages to states to be able to participate in some of the obligations and rights that are set out in that particular agreement. How do we go about dealing with making sure that they have, if you like, the capacity, whoever these people are, whoever these states are, have the capacity to at least engage in a meaningful way? And I think in terms of science, that's something that possibly Chuck Kennicott, if he's here from SCAR, may wish to comment on. I think it's very important. I think it's a common issue across many of these international arrangements. And there is a need to actually really seriously consider how do we get a universal approach to ensuring that what have been done, for example, in the treaty in the last 50 years with respect to the science is carried forward in a different time to a much more global community as a whole. Thank you.
Yeah, I just have a question which will reflect my ignorance. I get the impression that there are all these different regimes floating around, and the major problem seems to be to get a kind of a harmonization if one is going to take an integrative approach. Now, is there not any sort of higher court of wisdom or appeal where if there is a conflict, like Ambassador Bergugno and Professor Wang are saying, two different approaches or two different interpretations of the possible contradiction between the law of the sea on the one hand and the Antarctic Treaty on the other hand relating to the extension of the continental shelf. Now, is there not any higher court of wisdom where one, I mean, like the International Court of Justice or whatever, what do legal experts say? I mean, this would, you know, in my naive understanding of it, would be another way of approaching it if one can have some instance where one could arrive at some kind of, well, harmonization at least of regimes.
Okay. How about this point?
Well, I actually wanted to raise a question and comment on what Professor Wang said and Ambassador Bergugno. I don't see any contradiction between Law of the Sea Convention and developments in Antarctica, and contrary to what Ambassador Bergugno said, CRAMRA is not based on the assumption that there is a continental shelf there. There is no term continental shelf used in CRAMRA. The assumption of CRAMRA is that if you have a legal regime for the use of resources on a landmass, that regime should logically continue and apply to the extension of that landmass. And you are not talking about a status of that landmass, because if you claim that this is based on the continental shelf concept, that you are siding with claimant states, and this term is not used, and it's not, it would not have been possible to develop this type of regime on the basis of Article 4. So therefore, there is no contradiction between Law of the Sea Convention and a regime for Antarctica concerning mineral resources if it is based on the assumption that if you develop a legal regime for the use of mineral resources on the landmass, then you should logically apply it to the extension of this landmass underwater. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. So, shall we go to a little bit different part? And how about for the ozone protection or rating duration related to science and so on? Do you have any questions or comments?
Thanks very much. I was actually going to comment on the previous point. I think Vladimir largely made the point that I was going to make. Because I do not myself agree that there is a conflict between the law, law of the sea regime and the Antarctic Treaty system. There are potentially conflicts, but I think action has been taken to ensure that that is not the case. But one other point I would make, and this goes to the point of cooperation between regimes, if you will, or integration of regimes, a point that Jorge, I think, mentioned, and it was also mentioned from the floor. I would cite another area in which is that there's a good deal of important work going on between the Antarctic Treaty System and another regime is that between the system and IMO. When you look at Annex 4 of the Protocol, for example, on marine pollution, those provisions are largely implemented both under the Protocol itself and under the under MARPOL, so that you have a situation where there was a specific effort made to ensure consistency in approaches to dealing with marine pollution, specifically the special area provisions for Antarctica. And I think there's a good deal of work also going on in the area of polar shipping in terms of development of, again, in with the inspiration starting from the Antarctic Treaty System, but going on within IMO to deal with Polar Shipping Code, which would then, I think, make a major contribution to both environmental protection and marine safety in the Antarctic Treaty area. So I think that's an area that, and I guess Jorge mentioned the issue of the dealing with the for the treaty system, a challenge to deal with the Antarctic environment as a whole, and I assume here he's referring to the Antarctic marine ecosystem in particular as defined under CAMELAR. And again, that issue came up at the treaty meeting in Baltimore back in April, the idea of extending the Antarctic special area provisions to the Antarctic convergence. Now, that provision did not achieve consensus at the consultative meeting itself, but I believe for that issue, in terms of seeing how the specific provisions that have been developed and the imaginative provisions that have been developed with regard to protection of the environment south of 60, which are in a sense reflect an ecosystem approach, are in fact extended to cover the entire ecosystem, which goes north of 60. Now, that will require some creative imagination, the kind of imagination that the treaty has exhibited in the past, but I believe that the participants in the treaty can summon that up again to deal with that issue as well. Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. I'd like to comment on the issue of the continental shelf aspects. I very much share the view presented by George Galitzin and Tucker Scully. And in that respect, I don't entirely agree with Ambassador Begonio. And I think it is important also to remember one thing. Aunt Elsinger raised the issue of dispute settlement. The question is, who is the dispute between? Is it among two treaty parties? Then we have the dispute settlement mechanism under the different treaties, with the first being the Antarctic Treaty. Or is it a dispute between a non-state party and a claimant or a non-claimant, which is a totally different game? And I think that there are situations where you are better off not taking a conflict to a court. And I would claim that a dispute between a claimant state and a non-party to the Antarctic Treaty would be a really challenge to the treaty system as a whole. So so that would be my comment to that. But I also like to put the question to Professor van der Zwaag. I enjoyed your presentation immensely. It's always interesting to listen to you. But on one of your PowerPoint presentations, you had, if I didn't misunderstand it, a sentence referring to legitimate scientific research remains hazy. And for me, the qualification, legitimate scientific research, raised a question mark, and it's been touched upon before, and Judge Wolfram also touched upon the freedom of scientific research. Was that a legal comment, and what did you really mean by that? I think that was my simple question. Thank you.
Yeah, on that term was not mine. It comes out of the IMO discussions, and the resolution talks about legitimate scientific research. So that's kind of one of the issues yet to come back to this coming year, certainly for further discussion under the IMO umbrella. You know, you have the proposal by Australia and New Zealand floated, really. It's not, gone anywhere necessarily, but the idea that we would have a global safe list, which would then talk about legitimate kind of scientific research, is one option. But again, that has been no decision on that. So, I mean, that's going to come back for further discussion. And then again, there's a whole impact assessment document they're trying to produce as well with the scientific groups. So that may have some further implications of how you define what's legitimate scientific research. It may be partly based on that document. So it's kind of complicated where it is right now. It's not my turn.
Okay. So, Paul.
Thank you all for your excellent presentations and comments. Some of you have been involved in diplomacy and negotiations before the internet largely became active in the digital world. So I'd like to ask a question. In a way, how much easier has it become to understand the breadth and institutional interplay after the digital age? And what do you see as the opportunities in terms of understanding this interplay between institutions now that we have easy access across the pantheon of treaties and conventions.
So we can respond?
I would make one comment. You're right. I precede the internet, and I wrote technical reports in the era of fax machines and before fax machines. So it's quite an interval and quite an experience. Overall, I think it is entirely positive for its ability to quickly communicate, and that there's much higher participation from developing countries and small institutes and so forth. And so I would always be in favor of that. The one thing that is important is to keep things within scale. And I think sometimes you can over-participate any task and make it miserable for the experts and unsustainable. So, for example, I think it is an onerous task for a world-class scientist to respond to ill-placed comments by climate cynics and others that occupy a huge amount of your time. And that's just too burdensome, and someone has to find a way to filter and reduce that, or it will become a tactic to stymie really good science. And that you just have to look at it carefully and decide, if you want the best scientists writing the best reports, how can you be sure they have credentials and that they have rules of order that can be created so that you get the highest possible information on time without distraction. So it's all positive for the communication. It's a little bit questionable for participation in the scientific activities.
I was actually thinking more in terms of the text of documents, being able to go across many different documents easily, quickly, to compare and contrast components of documents, to understand the crafting procedures and strategies that were involved, and to incorporate them in new ways that effectively eliminate or borrow the wisdom of negotiators from different regimes.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think one, to really understand international relations, has to be on the internet surfing a lot, because what you have is multiple fora for many issues that come up, all the way from climate change, which partly comes under Kyoto, falls under CBD. That's the world we live in, a very fragmented world of international institutions. Partly some would say perhaps we don't have the World Environment Organization or the world whatever organization that we really need. So part of it is the international relations reality. We have a very fragmented world of nation states, so by all means, it's very fragmented, and I think to really keep up, you really see the multiple fora playing out in many ways. Ocean fertilization would be a perfect example. You know, General Assembly resolution, CBD, all these different conventions. So it's very complicated, and you do need to surf, you know, to get in there to find out day by day things will change.
Yeah. So maybe final comments.
Well, if I can follow up on that, there is an effort in the UN system to improve knowledge management in multilateral environmental agreements. There's also tools like Ecolex, which people use to do a more systematic search. My center, for example, provides a tool to Ecolex that searches Conference of the Party decisions for some of the major environmental treaties. But it actually turns out to be very hard to get those, to actually free them from treaty secretariats and find that material and organize it so it's not just random surfing with Google. So I think there is a whole issue finding the appropriate and expert knowledge and experience and making it available that's not just going to happen, you know, by natural people's desire to put things on the internet. And it is an area that the UN and other groups are looking at.
Okay, so thank you very much for discussing. We still have many discussions not concluded yet, but time is already coming, so we will have to finish at this stage. So thank you very much for joining that discussion.
Before closing the session, I'd like to welcome Professor Yamanuchi and thank him for his stewardship of this session and present him with
Thank you very much. Thank you, Nikki.